National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Being mayor of a major city comes with its own set of challenges. Today we're going to talk with two people with special insight on the job. Jerry Abramson has been mayor for 16 years, first leading the city of Louisville for three terms, and now as mayor of Louisville Metro, the consolidated government he championed. He has the long view of the job, and we'll ask him about the challenges and the changes he's experienced and where Louisville is headed today on Smart City. Also with us is Fred Siegel, author of the new book on former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Fred observed Mayor Giuliani both as a journalist and as a consultant to the mayor, and his insights about New York's turnaround in the hands of Giuliani are instructive for cities everywhere. We'll talk to Louisville Metro Mayor Jerry Abramson and author Fred Siegel today on Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. This year, Jerry Abramson began his 16th as mayor of Louisville, but for the past three, he's been mayor of Louisville Metro, the consolidated city-county government he helped form. He's the only person to have served three terms as mayor of the city of Louisville. In 1993, he received the U.S. Conference of Mayors Distinguished Public Service Award. In 1996, Newsweek named him one of the top 25 most dynamic mayors in America, and in 1987, Mayor Abramson was named by U.S. News & World Report as one of the top 20 mayors in America. On November 5, 2002, he was elected the first mayor of the new merged Louisville-Jefferson County metro government, capturing nearly 74% of the vote. Many people see metro government as the solution to a whole host of urban challenges, but few communities have been able to pull it off. You did, after several failed attempts in 2000. How did you do it?
Well, you know, you're exactly right. We failed several times, and over 40 years, we kept getting a little closer and a little closer. And this time, in the year 2000, we had enough people that had seen up close and personal how successful consolidating cities and counties had been around this area of the country. It had been over 30 years since Indianapolis, Nashville, going down into Florida, Jacksonville had been the three largest communities to consolidate. They consolidated in the late 60s. We kept trying the votes, trying to get people to vote, but alas, in 2000, the vote both inside the city and outside the city was in favor of the consolidation, 54% to 46%. So I think a lot of folks looked around us, saw some of the attractive things that had occurred in the cities that had merged 30-plus years earlier, and felt it was time for us to move forward. Plus, you know, you're talking about taking a 260,000-person city and consolidating it with its surrounding county, which makes us now a city of 700,000. I think more and more people began to see that we had far more that drew us together than separated us, and we should be thinking as one, with one elected official being held accountable and a council of 26 members that could be neighborhood-based and represent their neighborhoods accordingly.
You talk about consolidation as people moving toward a positive vision, but was there some problem that you and voters were trying to solve with consolidated government?
You know, we had these conflicts where the city would take a position and the county would take a counterposition, or vice versa. You know, the average citizen, when something went wrong, and I was the mayor for 13 years of the old city by itself, when something would go wrong, you'd find the city blaming it on the county and the county blaming it on the city, and citizens never knew who to hold accountable. Now they know who to hold accountable, both for things that go well as for things that don't go so well. We have a mayor that happens to be me at this point in time, elected by the entire community. And they have 26 council persons, each elected in their own districts. So they've got some real grassroots opportunities to engage with their neighbor who sits on the council.
How many governments were left in Jefferson County after metro government was formed?
Well, we had tried in several of our votes to either do away with some or do away with all of our 80 suburban cities, some of which are no more than four blocks large. And the largest one has about 18,000-19,000 people, expands during the day because it has a huge industrial park in it, and then retracts to the 18,000-20,000 citizens. So What we decided was that, for example, when we expanded our airport here, no one ever called any of the 80 suburban cities and asked for their position, or expanded our libraries, or expanded our parks, or expanded and renovated our waterfront along the Ohio River's edge. No one really called those suburban cities and asked for their opinion, because they were cities that were suburban cities that were set up to deliver direct services. They pick up the garbage, or at least they contract with private haulers to pick up the garbage, so that on a given street, each individual house didn't have to make a deal, if you will, with a specific garbage hauler to pick their garbage up. Or they band together on their five-block street so they could buy utility power for their streetlights, rather than have to individually get a streetlight from the local gas and electric company and sign a contract to pay for it. So those suburban cities were left intact. Every person that lives in a suburban city votes for or against me, the mayor. They also get to vote for or against a Metro Council member. But they still have their suburban structure, and they still pick up their garbage, and they pay a little more taxes if they live in those five blocks and get a little more services than those who are in the unincorporated area of our city. So the long and short of it, Carol, is that we have three distinct types of citizens in the new city of Louisville. We have about 250 or 60,000 of us that live in the old city, now called the Urban Service District. We pay the most taxes. We get the most services. You have about a third of our citizenry in the new city of Louisville live in these suburban cities. They pay a little more tax, and they get services that they pay for. And then you have a third of us living in this new city that are in the unincorporated area of what was the county, now the merged city county. And they pay the least amount of taxes, and they get the least amount of services.
Have you been able to save money with Metro government?
Well, you know, when you look over the last 3 years, especially the year 2003-2004, when we were going through great financial difficulties in this country of ours, you saw cities like Pittsburgh laying off police officers. You saw cities like Seattle closing libraries on the weekdays, opening them on the weekends. You saw cities like Cleveland laying off police officers, not starting fire classes for firefighters. We had none of those problems because we were able, through the synergies of consolidation, to be able to continue all our services at least the same level and never have to raise taxes, and more importantly, never had to decrease our services that were delivered to citizens. And that all happened because on day one when I became mayor, I was like Noah. I had two of everything. And, I gave me an opportunity as we right-sized our new government to go department by department to find out just how many employees we needed to deliver the service. And we have an awful lot of outstanding city and county employees who are now the new city metro employees. But, you know, if you had two payroll clerks in the old city getting out payroll and two from the old county getting out payroll, you probably didn't need four. You needed three. Maybe you could do it with two, but certainly three could do it. That meant one was left when the music stopped without a chair. And what we're able to do is decrease our numbers in government by about 10%, which gave us the ability financially to weather the recession situation that cities were facing across the country over the last couple of years, and continue to hire police, hire fire, keep our libraries open, expand our EMS program, etc.
Did you have any issues like salary equalization that actually caused costs to go up?
No, they didn't cause costs to go up, but it certainly doesn't do a lot for morale when you have two individuals sitting next to each other, consolidated, let's say, into the new Metro Public Works Department. One is a member of one union and the other is a member of another union. And in our enabling legislation, it said that all collective bargaining contracts were required to stay in place until they expired. And then you would have the employees vote for whichever of the unions they wish to be represented by. So in the first couple of years, we've been in a situation where we have two people sitting next to each other. They're doing the exact same job, and yet they have different pay schedules, different days off, different work rules. That makes it a little difficult to manage, and our department directors have really done a great job in just keeping everything moving forward. We sort of took as the symbol of our administration the duck, And we took that because we wanted our citizens to see us, you know, just calmly going across the lake like we had put together the city and county without a piece of, without any problem whatsoever, when in fact we're paddling like heck underneath water just to stay afloat. But financially and service-wise, we not only continue to deliver the services at least the same level, but we were able to put together our finances in such a way that when we went to Wall Street for our first bond rating, we were able to get a better bond rating for our new government than either the city or the county had in the past.
You were mayor of the city of Louisville. Now you're mayor of Louisville Metro. What's the difference?
Well, we went from 61 square miles to 387 square miles. We went from 255,000 to 700,000. And we have both an urban and a suburban perspective. So from my vantage point, I had to try to meld those concepts. And while in the old days we used to spend a lot of time working on downtown, 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 when you were talking about the old city of Louisville, now it's downtown, downtown. But, oh, by the way, we have commercial strips in the suburban areas, and we've got to make sure that those small businesses that are there and others, big box stores, are there supporting the contiguous neighborhood. So it's a much more expanded area, a lot more problems in the suburban areas along the lines of drainage concerns, which, you know, in the old city, you had your curbs, you had your sewers, you had all those kinds of things. In the suburban areas, you're expanding. So it's a very different job. And, you know, with 6,000-7,000 employees, it's a much larger government. But what the difficulties we found are the ones that any company would find when they were merging. One of the systems, the financial management systems of the old city and county, didn't connect. So we had to purchase a new financial management system. The communication systems, the old city fire couldn't talk to the county police, and the old county police couldn't talk to city EMS, and so we have to get those in order. The old HR systems, one government had PeopleSoft, the other one didn't. So all of those systems are something that we have to deal with and coordinate, consolidate. And then finally, culture. You've got to create, you know, where for 200 years the city disliked the county and the county disliked the city, now we're all clasping hands, singing Kumbaya together, saying we love you and we were wrong all those years. And so it's a very interesting experience.
You've said that your government will focus on four R's: research, risk-taking, regionalism, and revitalization. Tell me why you decided to focus there.
Well, you know, the future, in my judgment, is aligned with those four R's. And if you, the city that really steps up and begins to do those things, and to follow decision-making along those lines, I think will be the cities of the future. And so we've taken that, and you know, along with ensuring the quality of life and what we're doing with our new initiative in parks and air quality and the kinds of things that I guess you could say are risk-taking. On the other hand, they're certainly what we think makes our city a very special place to live and to work and to raise families.
You mentioned your park initiative. It sounds spectacular. Tell me what you're doing there.
Well, you know, we're very fortunate in Louisville. Over 100 years ago, the forefathers and foremothers, I guess, decided that they should reach out to Frederick Law Olmsted, who was the founding father of landscape architecture, many believe, certainly a world-renowned landscape architect, and bring Frederick Law Olmsted and his colleagues to Louisville to design our park systems and parkways. Frederick Law Olmsted designed Central Park in New York. He designed Boston Commons and many other park systems, Seattle, etc. So we have these wonderful, we call it an emerald green necklace in our urban area of these four or five parks and many parkways that connect the parks. And then a lot of smaller parks within these the area. But the four or five biggies, as we call them, are really the ones that have generated wonderful neighborhoods built around them that have been sustainable over the years, and the parks, both passive and active, have really made those neighborhoods very exciting places. So we decided that since 100 years ago, leaders of our community brought the Olmsted Group here, that maybe we ought to start gearing up for the next generation of parks. And what we've done is we've gone out into the suburban areas, and we are in a position to, we call it the City of Parks Initiative, thanks to the founder of Humana Corporation, David Jones. He is raising private money. The city is putting in public money. And together, we're about purchasing for our first initiative about a 27-mile ribbon of green in the suburban area that ribbon will be available for bikers and joggers and rollerbladers. But along that 27-mile ribbon of green, we're going to create three and possibly four new 400-acre parks, very similar to the ones that were designed by Frederick Law Olmsted's firm.
Mayor, you said in this year's State of the City speech that economic development is job one for you personally. Tell me how you organize your time to pursue economic development.
Well, you know, one day, about a month ago, someone asked me that same question. We went back through a month's schedule and found that about 55 to 60% of my time ended up being focused on the creation of jobs. That was either assisting those already here to stay and to expand or to attract businesses from other communities that have simply decided that the quality of life in the community that they're located in has changed to such an extent to the negative that they're looking for the place they want to raise their families and develop their businesses. So whether it's startup companies, entrepreneur opportunities, whether it's major manufacturing, we've just had two manufacturing companies move to Louisville. We just had an announcement of the existing Humana Corporation with another 1,100 jobs that they've just announced they'll be bringing on in the next 9 months. It's a little bit of a lot of things going on, a lot of life science businesses with the University of Louisville Medical School and research area that's been spinning off ideas, which then have been invested in business plans, which ultimately creates investment and job creation. All of that comes into play. But Carol, the nitty-gritty of supporting all of this economic opportunity is creating a community that has the quality of life that people want to live in. And that's vibrant neighborhoods, and that's a vibrant downtown, and that's, you know, that's crewing on the Ohio River, and that's rollerblading on one-way routes through the parks, and that's bike paths that we're developing, and just creating a nightlife. And so you try to make sure, along with the school system, to ensure that folks who come to live here or stay here and begin their families have confidence in the schools within this community. And the Broad Foundation out in L.A. just selected Louisville as one of the five best metropolitan public school systems in America. And we've got 97,000-98,000 children, so it's not a small system. So those are the kinds of things we work on to create economic development. The incentives are there, just like any other city would provide. The personal touch that I try to bring maybe is somewhat unique, but what you really want is a community that's vibrant and a community that is welcoming, and that's the way we try to do it.
In that same State of the City speech, you talked about infrastructure investments that you planned, and you told the audience, "I know infrastructure is a word guaranteed to inspire sleep in a lunchtime audience."
Yeah.
What are the issues that citizens ought to be paying attention to, Mayor, but just won't?
Well, everybody knows a pothole when they feel it or when they see it as they drive by. What they don't think a great deal about is what's going on under the roads. And that's, you know, sewers, drainage, water, all those kinds of public infrastructure concerns are legitimate. In cities, older parts of cities, we still have combined sewers, which simply means that when the rains come and fill up the sewer, the sanitary sewer, then you're having direct overflow out into the streams and tributaries of your community, and that's going to carry a price tag of significant millions and millions of dollars. Same thing with water lines, expanding them. The same thing to ensure that the bridges in your community and the roads, now that suburban areas are expanding, many of the roads in the communities across the country are called farm-to-market roads, which means that they were bringing farm products in to be sold into the city, but they really weren't wide enough for two school buses to pass. And now that development is beginning to occur, the infrastructure needs to be expanded to ensure safety. Many homes were built in areas that simply every time it rains because of the low area in which they were developed, you know, they got standing water in their driveway and in their front yard every time it rains. Those kind of drainage issues, road issues, bridges, and sewers and water lines are all the kind of infrastructure that every now and then needs to be upgraded. And many of our cities have gone many, many years without really getting after those issues. And we're about to do that as we speak.
As mayor for 16 years, you certainly have the long view on what it takes to build a city. What is the best investment you've made?
The best investment, boy, that's a tough one. I mean, you know, if you asked a citizen in the community, they would talk about, you know, taking back the waterfront, which used to be piles of salt and sand and scrap, and returning the water's edge along the Ohio River to parkland and areas where families can gather and enjoy the water. I'd probably say the airport, where we quadrupled the size, some $700 million plus. And as a result, UPS Air overnight came to Louisville, and they have created over 27,000 jobs because of the expansion of the airport. You know, it all depends on where your head's at, if I may. There are some who would point to those. There were some that would simply say a walking path in the park next to their subdivision. Or they'd say the nightlife that's been developed in downtown with the new venues of entertainment and food. Or they would say the bike paths. Or they might say the kind of incentives we've developed that have attracted businesses to grow and expand here. So those kinds of things touch people. At the same time, we're working on a system to upgrade the education of our kids, the ones who need the most help. We've created a business-driven, community-wide program for every child to read at grade level, and that doesn't sound like such a big deal, but the reality is that there's still 8,000-10,000 kids in our 97,000 student school system that have difficulty reading at grade level, and so we've now engaged adults in our community to work one-on-one with kids, and ultimately we want to be sure that the young men and women, when they graduate high school and decide where they're going to go next, that they have the basic educational skills to be able to be productive citizens and part of the economic growth and assets of the future of our hometown. So all of those things roll into saying it's been an exciting ride for 16 years, and we've still got a lot more to do.
During your term as mayor of Louisville, you were named one of the top 20 mayors in America, one of the top 25 most dynamic mayors. What does it take today to be one of America's best mayors?
Tenacity. You got tenacity. You patience. You know, I think to be a leader in today's marketplace, and it really is a marketplace, you've got to be able to crystallize your thoughts. You've got to be able to create a clear vision for folks to follow. And then you've got to be able to articulate that vision, whether it's in writing or whether you're able to speak about it. In today's marketplace, with the media as it exists, you have got to be able to energize people to follow you. And that means think, crystallize, develop the vision, and then articulate it over and over again in such a way that people get energized and join with you to create the momentum that ultimately gets things accomplished. You also have to have a love for your hometown. I mean, many of us in the mayor business have stayed just there, never run for any other office, because it's really where the rubber hits the road. If you love people, if you love your hometown, then you just stay at it and try to make it as great a place for your friends and for your family. I've got a 13-year-old son, and I certainly want him to enjoy his childhood here, and then ultimately when he finishes his education, I hope he hangs around a little bit.
Mayor, it's good to talk to you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Great talking with you, Carol. Thanks so much for inviting us.
Jerry Abramson is mayor of Louisville Metro. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about the impact of more police on the street. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Fred Siegel about his new book about former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, Prince of the City. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. We talked with Fred Siegel, who wrote the new book, The Prince of the City, on Rudy Giuliani's terms as mayor of New York. And, of course, Giuliani was very well known for putting more police presence on the street in New York. And now you've found a study by two academics who look at the real effects of that.
Yeah, you know, let's return to eighth grade science. You remember in eighth grade science that you learned that to prove anything scientifically, you needed what's called a controlled experiment, where you could change just a single factor and see what happens, and to be effective, you have to be able to do it again and again. Well, the problem is, Carol, that social science doesn't work that way. Cities themselves are pretty complicated places, so they don't make for very good laboratories. So if you want to answer the question, do more police actually result in less crime? That's a pretty complicated thing. It could be a coincidence. You could put more police on the streets, but then maybe the employment rate rises or a new gun law is passed by the state legislature. Very complicated stuff. And oddly enough, over the years, no one had ever been able to isolate just the addition of more police officers and does that result in less crime. So to prove this, you need a city that just every once in a while, unexpectedly, introduces more police officers into the street and does it again and again. Well, it would sound like there was never going to be such a situation, but in fact, there is just such a city, and it's Washington, D.C. Since 2002, there have been a series of these terror alerts in which the police department would extend the hours of the police officers and make sure they get out on the street. So these two academics have studied what happened to the crime rate, particularly in the areas in which the police presence was so concentrated, which would be around the Capitol building and the other federal buildings. And what they found is that there was a dramatic decrease in the number of property crimes. In fact, they kind of came up with a figure that for every dollar that cities spend on additional police officers, the cost of at least the property crimes goes down by about $4. And they sort of draw from this that it would probably pay most cities to actually double the number of people who are working in police departments, which is an astonishing figure for them to find.
That's fascinating. It would really be helpful, wouldn't it, if you could look at other such interventions in the same way. But I'm glad they found a way to look at this one. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Fred Siegel is the author of the new book on former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Its title is Prince of the City, Giuliani, New York, and the Genius of American Life. Fred is a professor of history at the Cooper Union for Science and Art in New York and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington. ABC News anchor Peter Jennings called his last book, The Future Once Happened Here, New York, D.C., and L.A., and the Fate of America's Big Cities, one of the most important books about the United States in the 20th century. In 1992, Fred, New York was considered ungovernable. 92% of then-Mayor David Dinkins' supporters expected the city to get worse over the long term. Decline was considered inevitable. But then along came Rudy Giuliani. What was the fundamental difference between Giuliani and his predecessors?
Giuliani had lost to David Dinkins in 1989. He spent 4 years studying city government. And he really knew where the levers were. Dinkins was a man of the old order. We'd passed a new charter in 89. That gave the mayor extraordinary power. Dinkins never used it, and he rarely met with his cabinet. Giuliani saw where the pressure points was and began to move very quickly. When Giuliani took office, the city was functionally bankrupt. The state was threatening to take over. He never talked about it. He simply took actions that allowed him to delay paying vendors, to get control of the situation. When Giuliani began welfare reform, he didn't begin it out of an ideological principle. He began it because you couldn't afford to have 1.1 million people on welfare, one out of every seven New Yorkers. It simply wasn't affordable. So what's overlooked because of Giuliani's operatic personality is just how smart he is.
Tell me why the city was considered ungovernable at that time.
Well, in the Dinkins years, there was a series of riots, a beeper boy drug runners riot in Washington Heights, a riot against Hasidic Jews in Crown Heights. And it was ostensibly, and this is unfair, but not entirely so, that the underclass had won. That if you wanted to stay in New York, you'd have to put a sign in your car that said, no radios here. In other words, go rob the other guy. There's a wonderful moment, wonderful in quotes, in 92. The Parks Commissioner is giving a speech in Central Park, and she's talking deservedly proudly about changes for improvements in Central Park. And as she's giving the speech on television, a dead body bobs to the surface of the water in Central Park. So there was a sense that it was all over. Dinkins, the previous guy before Giuliani, says it's not clear that New York can survive. We're going to go the way of Detroit. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the great senator, says New York's future is foretold.
The out-of-wedlock birth rate means that we're finished for the next 30 years. So people had given up. And when Giuliani is elected, the permafrost of pessimism is so thick that no one thinks he can make things better. They just don't think it'll get worse as quickly as under Dinkins.
You quote your father as saying that Rudy was a beloved son of a bitch. Now, are beloved sons of bitches typically electable?
No. And Giuliani's election is a fluke. He lost in 89 narrowly. He won in 93 narrowly. And it was all because there was a proposition on the ballot for Staten Island, the smallest and most isolated borough, to secede. Without that, Dinkins would have been elected mayor. We wouldn't be talking now. I wouldn't be living in New York. And New York would have gone on a very rapid downhill slide. There was a kind of evacuation mentality in 93, 94. You know, New York is different from many other older cities, and it's maintained a large upper middle class, highly educated population. They were heading for the exits.
That's only 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
Yes.
That's an amazing turnaround.
Well, the crime turnaround, and Giuliani didn't see the crime turnaround. Giuliani gives a speech earlier in his term. He says it'll take 10 years to get control of the situation. Part of the success of the early years is this dynamic duo, Giuliani and his police chief, William Bratton, who's now LAPD's chief. They take an idea from a guy named George Kelling of broken windows policing that's already been applied in the subways, that if you patrol small crimes, you get the big ones. So if somebody jumps the subway toll and you arrest them, you find out that one out of seven of these characters are wanted for serious felonies. They began to apply this citywide. It began to bring down crime. But then they did something else. They began what's called Comstat. It came from a guy named Jack Maple, a character out of a Damon Runyon movie, who walked around with spats and a Homburg. Maple began to track crime on a daily basis, and then he eventually computerized it. So instead of reacting to crime, cops begin to advance it. If anyone's been in New York, they would remember the East Village of those days. It was just anything goes. And so if the police raided Avenue A, the crime scene shifted over to B or C. What you did with Comstat is you anticipated where the movement was going. You were ready. And what happened was crime actually declined. It wasn't just that people were pushed to other locales. The number of people committing crimes declined because crime ceased to pay. And at the same time, and this is not widely known, the prisons didn't explode. In fact, New York's prison population didn't increase. Unlike other places where crime went down in New York because there was less crime, not because there were more people in prison.
You quote Bratton as telling panhandlers, get off drugs, get off the booze, get off your ass, and get a job. Why was he able to get away with that sort of blunt talk?
I think there was a sense that something had to be done, that the city was out of control. That life was unbearable. And what happened was the very wealthy had made their private arrangements. You know, they had private security, private schools, et cetera, et cetera. The middle class, the aspiring poor, were left out in the cold. And so when Bratton said this, everyone enjoyed it because no one liked having squeegee guys come up to them and shake them down when they come through the tunnels. These are the guys who come up to your windshield and say, you know, give me some money or I'll wash your windshield. Well, after they wash your windshield, you couldn't see out of it, so of course you gave them some money. So it was a moment which we were willing to tolerate this. Having said that, there were a lot of people who hated Giuliani's guts from the very start. There were a lot of people, and all the major entrenched interests who'd done well off New York's decline. Those people, and this will sound harsh, but it's accurate, who sold poverty to Washington. There were many, many liberals in New York who argue that poverty was to New York what oil was to Texas, that we, you know, it was our cash crop, that we would sell our poverty to New York, to Washington, we'd get back federal funds. So even as the city is dying, there are people who are doing well off its imminent death. And Giuliani angered all of them. So it was a very rocky stretch. He really governed against the grain of the city's entrenched political culture, much of which, by the way, is now returning under his successor, Bloomberg.
Really?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, Giuliani's the subtitle of my book is The Genius of American Life, and that refers to a speech Giuliani gave in which he said the genius of American life is that giving immigrants, poor people, a chance to rise in life, that you don't have to be poor forever. Well, in New York, we treated poverty as an industry. People would be kept poor for their lives, entire lives, and comfortable. Under Bloomberg, there's this concept of the luxury city. It's a city in which the middle class either serves the very wealthy or the very poor. But there's no room for an independent middle class. So Bloomberg has spent a lot of his time subsidizing very wealthy developer friends. So, for instance, some people will be aware of this because of the Olympics. He wanted to build a stadium on the west side of Manhattan, and he tried to sell a $1 billion property to the owner of the Jets for $100 million and argued that stadiums are the key to economic development. Now, anyone who knows anything about cities knows that stadiums have very little impact. not even as much impact as convention centers, which aren't very useful either. I know, I suspect people in many cities have gone through these fights, but with very few exceptions, these kind of projects don't do much. But they do do a lot for the people Bloomberg is connected with socially.
You are, I take it, not a fan of Bloomberg?
To say the least. People ask me what I am politically. I'm a Joe Lieberman Democrat, one of the remaining 12. Bloomberg is a guy, he's a limousine liberal. He's the reincarnation of Nelson Rockefeller.
I want to go back to your conversation about Bill Bratton.
Sure.
And his relationship with Giuliani, because it perhaps foreshadows at least some something about the way a Giuliani presidency would be operated. He and Bratton fell out.
Very much so. Part of the problem was they're the same person. Giuliani had his guys reading David Osborne's Reinventing Government. Bratton had his guys reading Champy's Reengineering the Corporation. They're kind of leader intellectuals. They're both two extraordinary men, very similar personalities. When the two of them were in the same room, there wasn't enough air for anyone else to breathe. So Giuliani should have risen above that. He should have accepted the fact that he had a very strong police commissioner who was an extraordinary man and simply accepted it. But he didn't, and it caused him a lot of problems in the second term. Now, the question for Giuliani on a national ticket is, has he gotten past that? Does he understand that he can't always completely dominate a situation? And truthfully, that's not clear.
That would be a pretty fundamental change in an adult.
It would. You know, people ask, does Giuliani want to run for the Senate? Absolutely not. He does not want to be one of 100, nor does he want to go to Albany. People are going to read the book in part to see what he would be like as president, and you can see what he would be like in part by how he governed the city. He is an extraordinarily skilled manager. Every morning at 8 a.m., he would gather all of his top staff, and they would hash out the issues of the day. What that meant is people couldn't evade accountability. The sanitation commissioner had to be there when the police commissioner complained about what sanitation was doing. And it produced a city in which the government was on message, coordinated, and extraordinarily effective. Giuliani did things that people simply said couldn't be done. We used to have separate police force for the subways, the housing, public housing projects, and the rest of the city, three police forces. Mayors for 30 years had tried to merge them. They'd all failed. Giuliani found the lever. When Giuliani wanted to institute a workfare program requiring able-bodied people on welfare to work off part of their check, he was told it couldn't be done. He found the lever. He found the lever in a particular union contract, and what he did brilliantly was play off one set of interests against another to get things done. But let me add one thing here. The problem with Giuliani is that his personality tends to capsize the situation in calm times. In other words, he's a man for crisis. When he came into office, New York was collapsing. 9/11, obviously. The questions that will be raised about him as he runs for president is, what would he be like if times are calm and ordinary? Would he capsize the situation?
What's your opinion? You've been a close observer.
I don't know. Truthfully, I think it's a legitimate question. And part of why presidential campaigns are so important is you get to see what people are like, again, under a different kind of pressure. Under managerial pressure, under the pressure to face crisis, he's fantastic. What will he be like under the political pressure of constant hammering, of constant conflict? And we don't really know the answer to that. I say that because while there was something similar in New York, his enemies were so transparently self-interested and so intellectually and morally bankrupt, it was easy to dismiss them. That won't be the same on a presidential campaign. For instance, he's facing someone like John McCain as a rival.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Fred Siegel. He's the author of the new book on former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Its title is Prince of the City, Giuliani, New York, and the Genius of American Life. The mayor claimed that being locked into partisan politics doesn't permit you to think clearly. Now he's thinking of running as a Republican. Does he still espouse that belief? I mean...
Well, no, look, there are certain beliefs that Giuliani had, or he acquired for political purposes. Before he first ran for mayor in 89, he had no position on the social issues. Giuliani adopted liberal positions on the social issues in order to run for mayor in New York. When he began to run for the Senate in 2000, his heart was never in it for a whole variety of reasons. He began to soften those positions. When he first got elected, he had to deal with a Democratic governor, Mario Cuomo, and he played Cuomo brilliantly, and he got the money he needed to get the city through its crisis. So he's very skilled. He'll do what he has to do to deal with the situation. And so I don't take these statements all that seriously. What I do expect is to see him modify some of his positions in order to satisfy part of the Republican base. But, Carol, I've been speaking about the book all around the country and Washington. I've been in Washington three times, and sometimes before very conservative audiences. And there's an admiration for Giuliani that allows him to get away with positions that normally would be unacceptable. And I think that flows from the fact that he's the first candidate for president since Eisenhower, who had an extraordinary set of accomplishments to bring to the table before he ran for office.
You mentioned earlier the genius of America, giving people of modest means the chance to move up. And you make much of the fact that the mayor believed that poor people deserved opportunities to have, as he called it, the same ladder of opportunities his parents had had. What was that ladder of opportunity made of as reflected in his policies?
In his father and grandfather's day, you could arrive here unskilled, go to work on the docks. You could work, and New York was always a manufacturing center, never heavy manufacturing, but it was the largest manufacturing city in the country in terms of light manufacturing. The docks are gone. The light manufacturing is almost gone. So if you're going to rise in New York today, you have to have a better education. And Giuliani hammered away at our wildly dysfunctional Board of Education. Our Board of Education was a lost continent. Most important thing he did was reform the City University of New York, because the City University of New York, which is an enormous institution, and the high schools are integrated institutions. In other words, CUNY graduates go to teach in the high schools. High school graduates go to CUNY. It's circular. So by improving CUNY, you begin to improve the high schools. And CUNY was once called the Harvard of the poor. In the late 60s, under Mayor John Lindsay, under the threat of riot, CUNY opened its doors to all students, regardless of how unprepared they were for college, and was turned into a remedial institution. Thanks to a man named Herman Medillo, the city's first Puerto Rican borough president, first Puerto Rican congressman, and a close ally of Giuliani, Medillo and Giuliani began to reinstitute standards at the City University of New York, and it's had an enormously positive effect. People now want to come to the City University of New York again, while they stayed away from it for many years.
Now, the mayor had lost much of his popularity prior to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Was it inevitable?
Well, that's a cliche that's widely distributed. It's not entirely true. In the summer of 2001, before the mayoral campaign, there were four candidates for mayor. Three of the four were running. Three of those four Democrats. Everyone assumed it would be a Democrat to succeed Giuliani, and without 9/11, it would have been. Three of those four ran on continuing what Giuliani had done. And even among core Democratic voters who were extremely liberal, they wanted to continue Giuliani's policies. Part of Giuliani's problem was he had behaved abysmally in public toward his wife, and people were rightfully horrified. You don't tell your wife on television that you're divorcing her. Granted, there have been a lot of troubles in the marriage before that. Just a story to give you a sense of what New York is like. It's the day Giuliani has made this announcement. I'm walking down on Broadway. I'm walking down to City Hall, and a large guy I don't know comes up to me and sticks his finger in my chest hard, and says, "So what do you think of your boy Rudy now?" And all I could say to him is, "What can I say? This is indefensible." So that was part of it. But when Giuliani looked like he was wavering, when there was a terrible incident in Central Park, a wilding incident, when a bunch of young boys went over the top and began sexually assaulting women, and Giuliani didn't respond firmly, the city wanted the old Giuliani back, and his numbers started to go back up. This idea that he'd lost all his support was a function of the idea that people had that he was just lucky on 9/11.
A number of American cities are today considered ungovernable. Common wisdom says they're too poor, they're too broken, they're too empty, too corrupt, too old economy. Are these cities simply lacking a Rudy Giuliani?
I can't say that they're simply lacking a Rudy Giuliani. I think they're lacking a will to reform. It doesn't have to come take Indianapolis and Cincinnati, two cities of roughly comparable size. Cincinnati has gone on a long downhill slide for the last 30 years. Indianapolis gets better and better and better. And so you can't depend, in other words, on having a charismatic manager like Giuliani. It's an unusual combination, charisma and managerial talent. You've got to have a political culture that allows you to engage in incremental reform over time. So in New York, with Bloomberg following Giuliani, some of what Giuliani has accomplished has been pushed back. Indianapolis, because it has a series of successful mayors implementing serious reforms in how government operated, keeps improving. Cincinnati, with its weak mayor and its endless racial politics, is sinking into the mire, even though its natural advantages are considerable. It's a much prettier city. It's got a much more interesting history and so on and so forth. No, I don't think you can depend on a Rudy Giuliani. I think you need a culture of reform, a political culture of reform. Now, once it takes place, it doesn't have to continue. In Detroit, Dennis Archer looked like he had put Detroit on the right path. He was succeeded by the hip-hop mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, who has made things much, much worse.
But this culture of incremental reform over time, to what extent is that driven by the leader?
It doesn't have to be. It can be driven by a leadership group. In other words, I don't think New York is a model for the rest of the country in this regard. In terms of specific reforms, Comstat, policing, welfare reform, absolutely. But in terms of the politics, its politics are too idiosyncratic. You can't wait for an extraordinary leader to come forward to rescue you. You need to have people from all walks of life coming together with a sense of the greater good of the city. Part of the problem of many cities is they're run by their interest groups. They're the people deeply invested in politics. So if you look at most urban elections, you look who turns out. It's people who work for city government directly or indirectly. Well, that's a long road to death because they will always vote their own interests, their own benefits, regardless of what the overall impact on the city is. So unless you have, in most places, again, unless you're lucky enough to get an extraordinary leader who comes forth, people are hoping that Antonio Villaraigosa plays that role in Los Angeles, and the book is out. But there's no, if you look around the country, there's no other Giuliani. Richard Reardon, Villaraigosa's predecessor, was a good mayor, but not didn't have remotely the same kind of accomplishments. So, you know, in Indianapolis, you had Steve Goldsmith, who was a very good mayor in the 90s, but he was preceded and followed by also excellent mayors. I think that's a more reasonable model for cities to hope for.
Well, it's a more reasonable model for cities to hope for, but not many cities get it. Tell me this. What do you think are the marks of a good mayor?
I think a good mayor keeps his eye on the overall well-being of the city. If you don't get crime under control, a city loses its primary asset, which is public space. What people like about cities is public life, being out on the streets of any good city. If a mayor focuses on crime, and then he worries about the overall business climate, level of taxation, level of regulation, the ability of businesses to get good cooperation out of city government when it's required, the city will do well. Too often what mayors do, this is cut deals with organized interests. Cities need to have relatively level playing field so people can feel they can start a business and succeed without being cut down by political interests.
Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much for having me.
Fred Siegel is author of Prince of the City, Giuliani, New York, and the Genius of American Life. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. The history of America is one of opportunity made possible by inclusiveness. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says that tradition is being threatened.
The triumphant story of American greatness is the story of opportunity. It hasn't always been a polite story, and progress has come in fits and starts. But America has steadily broadened the reach of basic rights and privileges. More Americans enjoy more freedom than ever before. America is the land of opportunity, and no one is to be denied a chance at success. Indeed, the roughest periods in American history have involved fights over opportunity. The Civil War to end slavery. The suffragette movement for women's right to vote, pitched battles outside factory gates between strikers and owners, the end of segregation and Jim Crow, boycotts in support of migrant workers, protest occupations by Native Americans, demonstrations by gay activists, legislative and legal battles over affirmative action, reverse discrimination, and Title IX. We are taught the history of America as the facts and figures of these events. But we mustn't forget that the history of America has always progressed in one direction and one direction only, toward greater opportunities for all. This is what unifies us left and right and makes America a beacon of hope around the world. From the right, we hear of respect for individual initiative and therefore less government. From the left, we hear of using government to ensure fairness and justice for everyone. But in each case, it's about opportunities, however these are best guaranteed. And it is this fundamental commitment to opportunity that draws enterprising and oppressed peoples to our shores. Opportunity means inclusiveness. When people have struggled throughout American history for an equal chance, what they have sought is to be included by the system. They have not sought to overthrow it. They have just wanted a fair chance like everyone else. The fight for integration was a fight to be included, to have equal opportunities irrespective of race. The fight for the vote was a fight to be included, to have the opportunity to participate irrespective of gender or race. The fight for the ability to unionize was a fight to be included, to even the playing field at the bargaining table, and so on. Opportunity has always meant inclusiveness. When people are excluded, when inclusiveness is checked, opportunity is denied, and the grand idea that is America is betrayed. The march of American history misses a step. What is at stake today is what has always been at stake. If we close our minds, our markets, our borders, and our liberties, we will create a culture of exclusion, and therefore a society in which opportunities are restricted. It only takes one or two steps backward to tumble and fall, for one precedent often begets another. If we renounce our historical commitment to opportunity through inclusiveness, in even the smallest way, we will lose what makes America great and what every scholar and politician of every stripe has always sought, the opportunity for everyone to succeed in whatever way he or she sees fit. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.